Thank you.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Sleater, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, October 19th, 2022. We have six cases on our calendar for today. Five are set for oral argument, four we have heard in person, and this is the fifth and final oral argument that we are hearing via Zoom.gov. All the rules of court apply, with exception, of course, you don't have to worry about standing or rising or a podium, but we will have 15 minutes for appellant's arguments, followed by 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, as well as any preferences that you have in terms of how to refer to either yourself or the party you are representing. Please note that there is a time, there's a square that has the time on it, so please be mindful of the time there. And with that, one final comment, as this is being recorded and no other recordings are allowed, but you will have access to this audio recording within a few days after. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Chris Heinze. I'm representing the petitioners in this matter. This matter before you today is entirely about service of process. And the totality of the arguments made by the Attorney General on behalf of the MPCA is that service of process upon the Attorney General was. These simple truths get a bit lost when you get into some of the case law offered by the Attorney General, as most of it is not relevant, binding, or even persuasive. But the AG was correct in his brief when he said that this is a simple case, as this case is wholly about service of process. In its motion at the district court and in the pleadings before this court, the sole argument made by the MPCA is that service of process was defective. That is clear and undisputed. But what is also clear and undisputed is that the Attorney General executed a document entitled, quote, waiver of service of summons, unquote. This waiver states in no uncertain terms that the AG, on behalf of the MPCA, waived all defenses and objections to jurisdiction based on a defect in the service of process. That language is clear and unequivocal.
If I could stop you there, the language says that that they will retain all defenses or objections to the lawsuit or to jurisdiction or to venue of the court, except for objections based on a defect in the summons, or two, in the service of the summons. And so, Basically, my understanding based on the case law is, for instance, you waive any objections to a defect in the summons itself. So there's not the proper signature, or the language or the heading is incorrect. They're waiving any objection to form in the summons itself, or in the service. So if somehow it wasn't served properly, if the person knew it wasn't served by an adult, it was served by somebody who was 17 years old, the recipient is waiving any challenge to that. But my understanding here is that's not what is being challenged. What is being challenged is whether service was timely. In other words, the service was untimely. And that doesn't seem to go to a defect in the summons or in service of the summons. That's a completely separate argument.
Your Honor, that's an argument that is proffered by the Attorney General. However, it was proffered without any sort of authority that somehow timeliness of service of process is somehow not something that would make service of process defective.
A couple of cases. So we have the Langer case. That's from the Minnesota Supreme Court. That's a 2009 case. And that talks about dismissing a late filing of an appeal because it was untimely. And they dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction in that case. That case seems fairly relevant.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I would point out that it was filing the matter with the court. So it was an untimeliness as a concerns filing, not any sort of untimeliness as a concerns service upon the person. So again,
there are two requirements here. One is filing with the court and then proper service. So service here is a statutory requirement. And there's no argument. My understanding is there's an argument in terms of the filing, but the argument is as to service, and service had to be done within 30 days. And that didn't happen. That happened, proper service happened on December 17th, not December 10th, which was the statutory deadline.
Correct, Your Honor, but I would point the court to the holding in McCullough, which specifically addressed this as it concerned administrative appeals. So it talked about two different cases, the Andrusik and the Skyline case, and it talked about the different requirements in those two cases. And both of those, just like with our case, had requirements as to the filing of the matter with the court and service of process upon the administrative agency for the order that was being appealed. In McCullough, the Supreme Court, state of Minnesota, stated that any issues, any defects regarding service are issues of personal jurisdiction, not of subject matter jurisdiction. So in 116.07.
I think counsel, Judge Reyes can speak for himself, but I think he's addressing a concern that I have, and I don't necessarily look at this case as a defect in service. I look at this case as one that was not timely commenced, because the statute requires certain things happen within a certain time, and that didn't happen. And then it looks to me like the waiver executed 7 days later is trying to correct that problem, but I don't know that the statute allows that problem to be corrected. Do you want to address that?
Sure. Well, the statute and all of the case law, the service of process as held by the Supreme Court is a defect. If there's a defect in service of process, it is a personal jurisdiction defect. In other words, it's not a subject matter jurisdiction defect. It is a personal jurisdiction defect. And personal jurisdiction defects can be waived at any time, either expressly or by action. And so, yes. So if you go back on the timeline of this case, we had on December 10th, we had filed with the court the petition, along with the filing fees, along with a proof of service. Then you have the Attorney General a week later saying, we don't think the proof of service is adequate, making a personal jurisdiction argument, but then thereafter on the same day waived the ability to make those personal jurisdiction arguments. So the court cannot hear a case if it lacks subject matter jurisdiction. And so had the petition not been timely filed, had it not contained the right fee, had it not done those sorts of other procedural things in order to give as a concern the court, then it would not be able to be heard by the court due to lack of subject matter jurisdiction. But this is a case concerning personal jurisdiction.
Isn't there another defect though? I mean, my understanding was that the December 10th filing did not contain a summons, which is the operative document that starts a cause of action. Is that right?
I think so, Your Honor, but again, any defect as a concern the summons would have been waived by the waiver of that was executed by the Attorney General.
I mean, we're not talking about a defect with the summons. We're talking about an absence of the summons, which is different. Doesn't that fall into the other category of problems that you were just talking about as a problem that would be something that cannot be overcome by the waiver of service?
No, because the precise language of the statute, Your Honor, says doesn't mention a summons. It simply says that the petition must be filed. It has to have, it can't be just a simple notice pleading, and has to go into detail as to why the petition is being brought. And then it says at some point a proof of service must also be filed. It doesn't get in some of the other statutes, Your Honor, in Minnesota concerning administrative appeals goes into much more detail as to how service of process, how other sorts of the mechanics of getting the matter started, whereas this one does not. And so the Attorney General's argument is that then we look to the rules of civil procedure. And if we look to the rules of civil procedure, The rules of procedure of civil procedure state that when there has been a waiver, then there is no need for any of those sorts of things. There's no need for proof of service. There's no need for it. Those arguments have been waived.
But the rules of civil procedure, which I just pulled up myself,
yeah.
Rule 3 says a civil action is commenced against each defendant when the summons is served upon that defendant. Sure. So if we're going to turn to the rules of civil procedure, if there's no summons, there's no action.
Correct, Your Honor, but that the summons has to do with the, and let me go back a little bit, because a normal in Minnesota has, you know, pocket service. So in a normal non-administrative agency appeal, if somebody's just suing somebody other for some civil reason, the case starts upon service. The filing with the court doesn't need to take place for a full year. Here, it's different because the case starts upon filing with the court, much like it does in federal court and in other cases, or in other states. So
the filing has to include a summons. I don't know of any civil action that can be commenced in district court, any kind, without a summons.
Right, but the summons still goes to a personal jurisdiction defect, not a subject matter jurisdiction defect. So yes, you're right. Just as
what's the authority for that proposition?
McCullough.
That a summons is a personal jurisdiction issue. The absence of the summons can be waived.
Because that would be a defect of service. Yes.
Where do you think which in McCullough stands for that broad of proposition? I'm not seeing that in McCullough at all.
McCullough goes through and it talks about that any defect in service, and a defect in service would include anything having to do with service of process, which would include a summons, is a personal jurisdiction matter, not a subject matter jurisdiction matter.
How is timeliness a defect in the summons?
Because its timeliness is, again, timeliness as a concerns filing is separate from timeliness as a concerns service. So timeliness as a concerns service is a defect in personal jurisdiction because it has to do with the summons. A filing, an untimely filing is different. That's a subject matter jurisdiction.
So Mr. Hines, can I clarify that hypothetically, if your client had timely served the Attorney General, in other words, within 30 days, but on the 31st day filed the petition with the court.
Yes.
By your explanation today, there would be personal jurisdiction, which is waivable, but it wouldn't need to be because it would be timely. Subject matter, because that 30-day provision filing the petition per the statute would be absent, and that's not waivable, and the case would be done.
Precisely.
Now, what would have happened? Thank you. What would have happened here if the Attorney General simply refused the stipulation of service and you had to personally serve? What would be the result?
Well, so I think, Your Honor, it would depend on what the court would, whether the court would agree with the Attorney General's argument that service wasn't adequate as was set forth in the proof of service in the, as was filed with the court. If the court were to determine that the proof of service as filed with the court was defective, thereby service was defective, and there was no waiver, then it would be able to be dismissed for lack of personal jurisdiction.
And why was the service not defective?
We don't believe the service was defective because we don't believe necessarily that the statute, well, a couple of reasons. There's the waiver, but absent the waiver, there's still nothing in there that talks about how the matter is to come into being, as opposed to other administrative agency statutes. It simply says that it needs to be filed with the court, and that a proof of service needs to be filed. And when you read that with the APOs themselves, the APOs go into detail and say, here's how you do it. And you send a copy to this address, you send a copy to this address, and that's what you need to do.
Would it have been defective because it did not contain a summons?
The service of process would be defective, resulting in a personal jurisdiction defect, yes.
Thank you.
So I'd like to just build on that a little bit.
I just want to ask a quick question.
Yes.
So statutory timeline, this is an administrative appeal to the district court, correct?
Correct.
And we construe statutory time limits strictly.
Yes.
And under Langer, such time limits are jurisdictional.
Yes.
So if they're jurisdictional and there's not a proper summons and there's not a proper proof of service because service hasn't happened yet as of day 31 going to Judge Sleater's hypothetical, which really isn't hypothetical here, then why isn't the court divested of all jurisdiction as of day 31?
Again, Your Honor, it's the difference between subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction.
Why isn't it divested of subject matter jurisdiction? Because the statutory timeline, the time limits, those are jurisdictional. And if that is not met, there's nothing, the court has no jurisdiction whatsoever.
The court would not have personal jurisdiction then if there was a defect in service as opposed to subject matter jurisdiction. As McCullough sets forth.
You only have 20 seconds left, but on rebuttal, if you can explain why time limits is a defect in the summons or the service, because I'm having a hard time following that, I'm not aware of any case law that says time limits is the equivalent of a defect in summons on the service in the summons. Thank you.
I'll address and rebut. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your arguments. Please state your name for the record and tell you your representative.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Serto. I'm a special assistant attorney general representing the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Your honors, this is a relatively simple and routine case for state agency practice. The timelines in Minnesota statutes for administrative appeals are to be strictly construed. Those timelines may require a filing within a certain amount of time or service in a certain amount of time. In either case, a party's failure to meet the statutory deadlines for filing or service divests district courts of jurisdiction to hear the case. That is what happened here. That is why the Pollution Control Agency moved to dismiss and why the district court appropriately dismiss this case. Counsel, this court should affirm.
Counsel, what jurisdiction does an untimely filing divest the district court of? Is it just personal jurisdiction? Is it subject matter jurisdiction? Is it both? Is it another type of jurisdiction? Because it seems like the case law is very unclear as to the scope, what is meant by jurisdiction. Sometimes it's referred
right.
to as jurisdiction,
sometimes
personal jurisdiction. And Justice David Strauss in the footnote in McCullough kind of called that out and said, you know what, even we're not being completely clear. So can you help clarify what untimeliness, what jurisdiction, if any, an untimely filed service and summons leads to, and what case law supports your position?
Yes, Your Honor. I have two answers to that. And one is that this court doesn't need to reach the distinction because even if personal jurisdiction is implicated, it is still amenable to dismissal because of the untimeliness. And that goes to the, you referenced McCulloch, which was the Supreme Court case that Judge Strauss authored in 2016. The follow-up to that on remand in 2017 was that the case was still disposed of as a matter of personal jurisdiction for untimeliness. Now, on the distinction of personal versus subject matter jurisdiction, there is a dividing line between the cases for when we are talking about the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure, for which courts, including the district courts, have discretion to extend timelines, and Minnesota statutes for which district courts do not. So if you look at Skyline, for example, that was a case in which the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure were being applied, and the deadlines came from those rules. Here, however, we have a statute, Minnesota Section 116.072, subpart 7A, which provides a specific statutory deadline. Under the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure, 81 and 82, district courts and courts in general do not have the authority to extend those statutory deadlines. So there is a dividing line between those two.
But Mr. Sergio, can I just clarify, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it kind of,
yes.
If you haven't completed your answer, isn't it true the parties may? So the point being, and I was thinking of this when I saw your brief, that the distinction was irrelevant. I know I would have failed civil procedure if I told the professor that. The point being is we know personal jurisdiction is waivable, and therefore we know a party can waive it either by just appearing in court or number two, literally. So would you agree, in this case, if the waiver service had included, because we're asking this question about defective service, would have said including timeliness of it, it would have been timely, it would have been waived, and there would have been personal jurisdiction, and there already was subject matter jurisdiction because the petition was filed within 30 days.
Yes, I would agree that if a waiver had applied to timeliness, that could be waived, but not the statutory deadline, which is a under Langer, that's to be strictly construed, and that this court...
But if it was, if and I think we do our... the public disservice by blurring these two. We already said personal jurisdiction has to do with service. Yeah. It is waivable, and you agreed the parties could waive it. That would not contradict any strict construction of the statute, because your client would have waived the timeline and the case would be.
Right. All of that is correct. And where this collapses to is that the Form 22 waiver of service, which is consistent with and implements Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 4.05, does not waive jurisdictional defenses explicitly in the language of the waiver itself and according to Minnesota Rule 4.05D. Those jurisdictional defenses are preserved, and that includes personal jurisdiction. The motion that was made by the Attorney General's office to the district court was one for lack of jurisdiction.
But just to clarify, though, it ineffective service is also a personal jurisdiction. So it didn't waive all personal jurisdiction issues. And that's what we're kind of narrowing it down to is a untimely service in also an effective service.
That's correct. So in this case where we had something that was dropped in the mail at the last possible moment of the deadline, no service occurred. Now this was briefed below during the appellant's argument a moment ago. Mr. Hines did offer an argument that appellants believe that service that was issued on December 10th was not defective. That was resolved by the district court in ordering dismissal and was not appealed here. The question that's being appealed here is whether or not the December 17th acceptance of service retroactively cured that defect. But the district court did decide that the December 10th mailing was not service and was not effective. That is not being appealed here, and that argument has been waived even though it was just presented. The fact is that that December 10th mailing was not effective upon mailing because the rules of civil procedure apply, including Rule 4, which requires personal service. And it did not include a summons, which, as Judge Frisch appropriately noted, is a requirement to commencing a lawsuit and effectuating service.
So can we talk about the summons? I mean, you can probably tell that I'm interested in the absence of the summons in this case and how that operates. Is the absence of a summons, does that relate to personal jurisdiction, or is the summons necessary to invoke the subject matter jurisdiction of the court? I'm trying to figure, and is there some authority that you can point us to that defines where the summons falls in the jurisdictional spectrum?
Yeah, so I wouldn't want to give you the incorrect case name. This issue was briefed in the district court briefings. So if you go to the docket list that was filed here, you'd want to look to, I think it's docket number 10, where we briefed this. And of course, Twin Cities Petroleum had its own briefs where we spoke about this and quoted a number of cases that stand for the proposition that a summons is the process by which the court exercises personal jurisdiction over the litigant.
Mr. Sirdo, was that the argument made? I didn't see that argument in the record. I thought it was simply a timeliness issue, and your argument to the to us and it was to the district court is it was untimely, and that's not the same as ineffective. Therefore, we haven't waived it. Did I miss that in the record? Did your client argue that a lack of summons? So that even if it had been timely, but without a summons, it would not have invoked the jurisdiction of the court.
Yes. And that is at docket entry number 10 at the district court proceedings. That's the opening memorandum filed by Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It's short. I think it's maybe 4 or 5 pages. At the time, what we were making sure we buttoned up and put to bed for the district court purposes was under this statute as constructed, that service was a requirement and it didn't happen here, including because there was no summons in the initial filings that were submitted to the court on the at the end of the day on the 30th day of the time period. So that is something that was presented to the district court and argued below. And I think we make complete reference to it in the papers here, but because it wasn't the specific issue being presented on the appeal, it isn't as well developed, but it is in the record.
So counsel, a couple of questions. One is that I think you mentioned that the district court had decided that the December 10th service and including the summons was not effective. So that was not an issue, and that's not being argued on appeal. Is that what I heard you say?
Yes. What I'm saying is below we had a fight over the December 10th and December 17th dates.
Okay.
Where the district court went was to find that the service didn't actually occur until the attorney general accepted service on December 17th. It was only effective as of that date, and therefore it was 7 days too late. If the December 10th service had sufficed, it wouldn't have been able to reach that conclusion.
Okay, and I want to go back to my earlier question, because I'm not sure you had a chance to completely answer it. I'd like to give you that in terms of, and I wish I could remember exactly what I'd asked, but it was something to the effect of, if you can cite to case law that states that under a statute, if something isn't timely filed or served under a statute, that divests court of jurisdiction, whether it's statutory jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction or whatever jurisdiction that may be.
Yeah, so there is in the respondent's brief a section where we go through the continued application of said subject matter jurisdiction to statutory deadlines, particularly in the tax context, but also in, for example, the civil forfeiture statute. District courts and this court continue to routinely apply, and these are CF sites to be sure, because no court that I've seen has directly addressed this question since the two McCulloch decisions we've been fighting over. But in all of these cases, courts are continuing to apply subject matter jurisdiction where the statute requires service by a particular deadline. Now, if we go back to Langer, which required that strict construction of statutory deadlines, plural, that does extend to service under Thole, which was dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, the T-H-O-L-E.
But so just to clarify, though, again, we still have the two different jurisdictions and they need to be strictly applied, but they are two separate ones. So that our case law has caused the confusion by just saying jurisdiction. Right. But the point being, in this statute, for instance, the second to the last sentence refers to the filing of the petition. So that and that alone would be subject matter jurisdiction, has to be within 30 days. And the second sentence separately refers to service, which everybody's construing to also be within 30 days. And so that would be personal jurisdiction. And so when we say jurisdiction, there still is the distinction. So to strictly apply it here, there's two separate jurisdictions that are being considered by the one statute.
Well, so this is again where I think there is a divide, Your Honor, between the rules of civil procedure, where courts have discretion over the deadlines and timeframes that they provide, and statutory grants of authority from the state legislature, where the state has said these two things need to happen as a matter of statute before a court consider a case. The AGO would submit that it is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction and that the legislature has not authorized the court to hear a case where those things have not occurred in a timely fashion.
But we would have to ignore McCulla. The bottom line, it's still two, and it will always be two. And there's two types of jurisdictions, even under the statutory created cause of action. Is that correct?
Right, right. But then even under McCulloch, you've got the result that dismissal is still appropriate where an objection to jurisdiction is lodged, personal, statutory, or otherwise, the case should still be dismissed for
Well, because they clarified that with subject matter cannot be waived, dismissed. Personal jurisdiction, if that is late, can be waived.
Yes, right. But it was not, in our argument, it was, in either case, it was not waived here under the operation of the rules of civil procedure and the specific language of the form, all objections to personal jurisdiction and to subject matter jurisdiction were preserved. And that was the basis on which the Rule 12 motion proceeded. Not for defective service. There is no dispute here that service occurred and was not defective when the AG accepted service on December 17th. But that was not a waiver of an argument that it was outside the timeline required by statute. Because the appellate in this case did not file in accordance with the statutory requirements of Section 116.072, sub 7A, this court should affirm the ruling of the district court. This case was appropriately dismissed, and it was the right result here.
Counsel, I have one last question, and that is, can you explain to me why timeliness does not fall under one, a defect in the summons, or two, in service in the summons?
Yes, two answers to that. One is, if you go and take a look at, there's one case that in the reply brief appellant provides, it's called Wilkinson. It's actually a District of Minnesota case applying this statute, this concept. And even though that was cited by appellant, I will note that this is a direct quote from the very page that they cite. Where a plaintiff waits until the eve of the deadline to commence service of process, fails to provide a legitimate reason for the delay, and service is ultimately untimely, it's not an abuse of discretion for a court to dismiss without prejudice for insufficient service. So this really is still a jurisdictional issue, and that Wilkinson case doesn't blur the line between what is ineffective service, for example, serving the wrong person, leaving it under a doormat, not finding an adult at home, having the wrong name on the summons. Like, those are defects in the summons, which, by the way, did not exist on December 10th, or in the service of process because they didn't do it in the appropriate way. That is the defense that is being waived when somebody executes a standard form 22, which courts and practitioners should be encouraged to implement for efficiency and economy purposes. But those types of defects don't relate to whether or not somebody has met their statutory obligations. And certainly nothing in the blank form would waive a defendant's ability to raise those very issues.
Thank you, counsel. See, there are no other questions. So we will turn back over to counsel for appellant, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So going back to your original question prior to the Attorney General speaking and building on what he just said. So Wilkinson talked about timeliness as a defect in service. So yes, it dismissed for it, but it talked about timeliness as a defect in service. And to your further point about case law that talks about statutory timeliness as being a subject matter jurisdiction issue or being a personal jurisdiction matter issue, I would point you to McCulloch once again. And that contradicts what the Attorney General said. And if I can, I'll read part of that case. They looked at both the Andrusik case and the Skyline Materials case in McCulloch. And it says, we ordered the dismissal of both cases because the landowners had failed to serve the government entities in accordance with a statutory requirement in one case, being Andrusik, and the Minnesota Rules of Procedure in the other, being Skyline. And they say, although both opinions use the term jurisdiction to refer to the inadequate service process, neither involved subject matter jurisdiction. The question yes.
So, counsel, when we, you know, I know you're characterizing this as a matter of personal jurisdiction. When we look at Rule 4.05, which deals with the waiver of the summons, if you look at subdivision E, it specifically provides that waiving service of a summons using the form that Mr. Smith or Mr. Cerdo has identified does not waive any objection to personal jurisdiction or venue. And it says personal jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So how do you get around that? that the waiver is not a waiver of personal jurisdiction?
Because this is a unique case, Your Honor, in that it involves an administrative appeal. So for example, if I was starting a civil lawsuit and I was suing someone, you know, perhaps someone who's out of state, right? And I served them by mail and sent them this waiver form and said, we want you to sign this so that we don't have to spend the money on service. They can sign that waiver, which means I can't bring any questions about, you know, whether were they served or not, or whether it was timely, whether there's any defect. They can still make personal jurisdiction arguments about whether they have minimum contacts with the state. Personal jurisdiction are those two prongs, whether there was service of process and whether one has purposely availed themselves to that court. So in most civil litigation, that's where that would apply. This is just a weird circumstance in that, of course, the MPCA, being a government agency, has already purposely availed themselves to this court. So that's how that works.
And I appreciate the factual distinction that you're raising. Is there some principled interpretive guide that you can give us that would allow us to make that kind of a distinction among actions that are using a waiver form under the rules of civil procedure?
Well, I guess I would point you to the plain language of the statute. And I know Mr. Cerdo talks about that he still retains all of his objections based to jurisdiction. But again, so long as they aren't based on any defect in service of process. So that's all you need to look at, I think, Your Honor, that, you know, he has a right. And if you look at Black's dictionary in terms of what a waiver is giving up of a known right. They had a right, presuming that the service was ineffective on December 10th, to bring an action for a defect in service. They waived that right when they signed the waiver. It just so happens because of client that they don't have any other options or any other arguments as it concerns personal jurisdiction. So that's what I would point Your Honor to. So again, to Judge Reyes's point, the timeliness certainly is a personal jurisdictional defect as set forth by the Supreme Court in 2016. The arguments that Mr. Cerdo makes about further case law that has happened since 2016, I would point that none of those are published cases in the Court of Appeals, and certainly none of those are Supreme Court cases. The cases are even cases is being generous, because they are opinions by the tax court, which, as set forth in the briefing, is no real court at all, and it's just an administrative agency. So I'd like to conclude by just saying again that this case is simple. The petitioners filed a petition with the district court in a timely manner, paid the filing fee, and also filed the proof of service. Followed everything according to statute. 7 days later, the AG got upset, argued that the service of process was ineffective, but still signed the waiver of service of process. And so because they signed the waiver of service of process, they're precluded from making any arguments regarding service of process. And to that end, the waiver says any defects based on the summons or in the service of the summons. And if there's a defect based upon the service of the summons, then the net effect of that is that nothing got served. So in terms of the question of the absence of the summons, it has the same net effect as any defect in the service of summons, because any defect in service is no service whatsoever. And it is the same as though the recipient received nothing. The district court conflated a 2015 unpublished Court of Appeals case, saying that brought confusion with a 2016 Supreme Court case. That's just not simply how the law works. The law was set forth that is required to be followed by the Supreme Court in McCullough, and thereby this court must vacate the order of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your briefing and oral arguments here. We appreciate it. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. That is our last case set for oral arguments today, and this court is now in recess.